All rise. The State of Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable James R. Morelli presiding.
Morning. Please be seated. Is a personal restraint petition of Bourgeois.
Good morning, and may it please the court, and despite every travel delay imaginable this morning, my name is Jeffrey Ellis, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bourgeois. Nearly 25 years ago, when he was 14 years old, Mr. Bourgeois was convicted in King County of aggravated murder. Whatever's left on the, I'll play dangerously. If there's any time left, I'll reserve. Otherwise, no, thank you. 25 years ago, nearly 25 years ago, and when he was 14, Mr. Bourgeois was convicted of aggravated first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison, the only possible punishment at the time. In those almost 25 years, Mr. Bourgeois has done very well in prison and actually accomplished the writing of a law review article, which puts him still one ahead of me. He was resentenced to a minimum term of 25 years, and the question in this case is whether that 25 years should include good time. The statute says no, and we argue that ex post facto suggests that the answer should be yes.
Are you challenging the 2014 amendments or the 2015 amendment or both?
Both.
Okay.
And it's with some humility that I have to admit that my opening mandamus focused on the 2015. It should have included the 2014 amendment as well, and that was made readily apparent by the respondent's answer.
It looks like the premise, as you clarified in your reply brief of your argument, is when you're doing the ex post facto analysis, comparing these more recent statutes to the prior law, that you can't look at the prior law in terms of an unconstitutional statute.
Our position is there's no question but that Mr. Bourgeois' ultimate sentence was reduced. But it's our position that when he was sentenced to life without parole, even though his sentence could not be reduced, it was life without parole, he was still nevertheless entitled to earn good time. He was still earning good time to no good effect at that point.
What's your authority for the proposition that he was still earning good time?
Well, because aggravated murder is essentially first-degree murder with an aggravator. And it is controlled in part by 1095, but it's also controlled by the SRA. That's why you see when the Miller fix happens that not only is 1095 amended, but 994 is amended. The sentence for aggravated murder is included in 994A, and there's a good time provision in 994A that says anybody convicted of any serious violent offense is entitled to earn certain good time. And then after Mr. Bourgeois' conviction and sentence, there were limitations put on the ability to earn good time towards mandatory minimums, including murder in the first degree. But again, that happened after Mr. Bourgeois committed his crime and was sentenced.
But if we look as a comparison point to 1095030, as it existed at the time of the murder, it had provisions for flat time.
It did, and I'm making a very fine distinction, perhaps one that I can't sell to this court, but I'm still going to try, which is that the provisions at the time said that his sentence could not be reduced by anything, including good time. So no furloughs, the indeterminate sentence board couldn't release him. But there was no provision that existed at the time that said he wasn't able to earn good time. So if you stand in Mr. Bourgeois' shoes from 1993 on, he had every incentive, if the law were going to change, to behave well and to earn that good time. And in fact, he did earn that good time. And then it's in 2014 and clarified in 2015 that the ability to earn good time during the first 25 years was removed.
Can you reasonably argue that the notice to someone who commits the crime of aggravated murder in the first degree, you know that your punishment is going to include good time? I mean, is that that's?
I think you could reasonably argue that. I mean, I recognize that this is a bit of a logic problem. Maybe it's the Schrodinger's cat of the law, which is, can you earn good time even though you're not going to get the benefit of that if life without parole remains the sentence. But those two provisions existed, the provision that said you can earn good time. At the time, it was 15% for serious violence. But and what 1095 said was that the sentence couldn't be reduced by any earned good time. So it contemplates on some level the earning of good time, but that it made no difference.
How would we distinguish McNeil if we accepted your argument?
Well, McNeil makes an argument that the fix is unconstitutional, and it specifically says there are, it was a broad-based argument, and it specifically says, I believe in a footnote, that there were not any other specific arguments made.
The arguments made in McNeil that we should compare to sentences for certain crimes that allowed good time because there wasn't any allowance for good time here. It seems to fly in the face of your argument in terms of how it approaches that argument.
Well, I certainly concede, as I did earlier, that the ultimate sentence that Mr. Bourgeois or anybody, especially anybody sentenced under the provisions dealing with those 16 and under, was reduced. Ultimately, it's up to the parole board to determine whether he should be released, but he now has the opportunity to be released at 25 years. McNeil says that's fine. What McNeil doesn't speak about are the good time provisions, and specifically, and there wasn't any particular argument that was briefed or made in that case that McNeil was earning good time while he was sentenced to life without parole under aggravated murder. Imagine, if you will, that the fix had never happened. Imagine if the legislation had never happened. It's not as if a superior court, wouldn't have sentencing jurisdiction. It would, and it would be guided by a very sort of broad range, if you will, because aggravated murder includes first-degree murder. The mandatory minimum would be 20 years. And the maximum for the class of crime would be life without parole. And so that would be the sentencing discretion of a Superior Court judge if the legislature had just said, we don't agree with Miller Montgomery. We're not going to pass any law. We know that the law is retroactive. In that case, the defendant would be earning good time because he always was earning good time. And so any provision later that came in and stopped that ability to earn good time would be, and I suggest is, ex post facto.
To the extent your reply brief seems to take a little broader swipe at it, saying our benchmark in Powell's language is not the unconstitutional statute. It has to be the law that existed without regard to that. Doesn't McNeil reject that? Doesn't Palatos expressly reject that, saying that an unconstitutional statute is still a statute? It still gives notice of the punishment.
And I actually am embracing that concept. You know, the statute is still the statute. It's unconstitutional, so that particular punishment, life without parole, cannot be imposed. But everything else remains in place. That's my argument. The mandatory minimum remains in place. The class of crime maximum of life remains in place. And so do the good time provisions that allow earned early release throughout the entirety of that person's sentence. So if no fix had ever been passed, a sentencing judge could impose a determinate sentence of life without parole if it found irreparable corruption, could impose a determinate sentence.
That's not the sentence we compare it to, though, right? We compare it to the sentence, to the statute that he was actually sentenced under, not what happens, what could have happened after the statute was found unconstitutional.
Absolutely, but it's to illustrate my point is that you are... The statute is removing the ability to earn good time, which existed under the previous statute. And so that provision has been taken away by virtue of the new statute. So there's a decrease, but on the other hand, there's the removal of a provision that contains a liberty interest. I'm not sure.
What about Justice McLeod's concurrence, you know, where she says the majority doesn't do this quite right? What we really do is we just look at whether one penalty is more severe than the other, and certainly 25 years is less than mandatory life without any good time.
Well, I expect that's what you're going to hear from my esteemed opponent. I would suggest that's too broad of a cut, because again, it is in some respects but it's not in terms of the ability to earn good time. He should have a liberty interest in that continued, that couldn't be taken away, and that should be applied to the 25 years, which I'll acknowledge is rapidly expiring. It's expiring in June.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Paul Weiser, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the board and the Department of Corrections. Mr. Bourgeois was sentenced in 1993 and received a sentence of life without parole and was essentially told that he would be dying in prison. Now, as a result of the 2014 and 2015 amendments to the statutes, to both 1095 and to 994A, he now has a chance after 25 years. Not only just a chance, the presumption that he'll be released after the conclusion of his 25-year minimum term. But he insists, nevertheless, that somehow there has been an ex post facto violation and that something has been taken away from him. There is no ex post facto violation here. Nothing increased Mr. Bourgeois' sentence, nothing increased the quantum of punishment that he'll be receiving, and nothing was taken away from him. He was never in a position to earn any good time during any of the time that he has been in prison.
Earn it or benefit from it?
Earn it, Your Honor. I think the statute precluded not only his receipt of any benefit, but that his any receipt of an accounting that he receive any good time during the time that he was serving a life without parole sentence. And I would remind the court that his sentence was...
Counsel seems to put a different spin on it, that he can accrue good time, he's just got no place to spend it. What's wrong with that analysis?
Your Honor, I think the fundamental flaw in that is that his sentence was not imposed under the Sentencing Reform Act. The former statute, 994A-150, the version that was in effect in 1992 at the time that he committed his crime, applied only to sentences imposed under the Sentencing Reform Act. By definition, Mr. Bourgeois' sentence was not imposed under the Sentencing Reform Act. It was imposed under RCW 1095. And also, parenthetically, I would note that the sentence... His crime was not considered, ironically, a serious violent offense for purposes of that statute, because if you look at the SRA definitions of serious violent offense, it does not include aggravated murder. It includes first-degree murder, but it does not include aggravated murder. So he was not receiving any amount, 10%, 15%, or any amount of good time during that time that he was serving his minimum term or that he has been serving his minimum term.
Should we look at it that he was convicted of first-degree murder with aggravating factors as opposed to aggravated murder as some sort of different crime?
I think we can, in the abstract, look at it that way. However, Your Honor, his sentence was imposed under RCW 1095, which is over and above what the first-degree murder statute requires. And that his sentence is and will always be a sentence under RCW 1095. It was never an SRA sentence, and it can't be considered one now. Now, when I came up here today, I wasn't sure exactly which argument I'd be making, if I'd be making the purely statutory argument or if I'd be making a Miller versus Alabama argument. We had sort of a shift in the theme that Mr. Bourgeois was pursuing. But he apparently has abandoned the purely statutory argument he had made previously. And his argument now seems to be, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing it, but that when Miller versus Alabama was decided on June 25th of 2012, his sentence was immediately rendered void or unconstitutional and somehow reverted to being a Sentencing Reform Act sentence, and thereby he was instantly entitled to start receiving early release credits, that he had a liberty interest in receiving early release credits. Miller did not hold that RCW 1095 or any statute like it was unconstitutional. And in fact, the court didn't even hold that Miller was retroactive until just January of last year in Montgomery versus Louisiana. But more importantly, Miller was concerned solely with the length of the confinement term, specifically mandatory life without parole for juvenile offenders. It concerned sentencing discretion only, and at most Miller entitles an individual sentenced in Mr. Bourgeois's situation to life without parole to receive something less than life without parole.
Well, does it entitle him to that, or does it entitle him to an individualized consideration of his case to decide whether that's the appropriate sentence?
I believe that's what Miller says. It doesn't preclude life without parole sentences in all circumstances, but it does say
that... You can't have a cookie-cutter rule that says all juveniles convicted of this crime get this sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was the mandatory nature of it that the court struck down in Miller. But Miller didn't say anything about time credits, good time accounting, entitlements to earned early release credits, or anything of the nature.
Does a prisoner have a liberty interest in good time credits if a statute provides for earning them?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that if the prisoner has been sentenced to a type of sentence where he is allowed to earn credits, there is a liberty interest that's involved. I would say that in Mr. Bourgeois's case, he is not entitled to receive any earned or release credits during the 25-year mandatory the 25-year minimum term that he's serving.
And that's simply because he wasn't sentenced under the SRA?
That's correct, Your Honor. He was sentenced under 1095, which categorically precluded the award of earned early release credits to those prisoners. And as I said, his sentence was never subject to the SRA, and it was never subject to former 994-150.
For ex post facto analysis, what's our comparison point, our benchmark, the prior law? How do we decide what to look at?
We look at, Your Honor, the quantum of punishment that was prescribed on the date of the crime, Mr. Bourgeois' crime in 1992. And at that time, the only punishment that he could receive for aggravated first-degree murder was life without parole.
If that statute had been held unconstitutional prior to the commission of the crime, but prior to a fix, different result?
If the statute had been struck before the crime occurred?
McNeil talks about Furman and ends up talking about a distinction that, well, it's different where the U.S. Supreme Court had made a decision invalidating a statute before the crime was committed.
Your Honor, I would say that the punishment that was prescribed at the time of the crime is the benchmark that we use. And at the time that he committed his crime, he was given notice that the punishment was life without parole for committing aggravated first-degree murder. I don't know if that responds to the court's question.
It doesn't matter to the validity of the status of the statute with respect to its validity at the time of the commission of the crime?
I think that would be something that you would have to examine, but obviously that did not occur in Mr. Bourgeois' case. There was no striking of the statute, at least the life without parole part of RCW 1095 for a person under the age of 18. Now, we know that statutes are presumed to be constitutional and that the party challenging the statute has the burden of proving unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt. Nothing about the Miller Fix statutes, either the 2014 or 2015, caused an increase in the quantum of punishment that Mr. Bourgeois received for his 1992 crime. And in fact, as the court has pointed out, In re McNeil, at least in a general sense, found that there was no ex post facto problem caused by the 2014 statute, SSB 5064 in 2014. And that was in a more general sense. It didn't consider the fine-tuning issue that we're involved with here with the good time credits. But it did find that there was no ex post facto argument that could reasonably be made about that statute. And the 2014 version of RCW 994A729 did not say that juvenile offenders were entitled to earned early release during their minimum term, notwithstanding the provisions of the other statutes. And that's why I say that it was just a clarification when the legislature in 2015 passed the statute that amended 729 to make clear that the entitlement to earn good time did not occur until after the passage of the 25-year minimum term. There's been no ex post facto violation in Mr. Bourgeois' case. His sentence has been dramatically reduced, and the quantum of punishment has not been increased. We'd ask that the court dismiss Mr. Bourgeois' petition. Thank you.
Thank you.
In part because I can't set the clock at less than a minute, I'll give you round up to a minute.
I'll waive any rebuttal unless the court has questions.
Thank you very much.
State versus Butler.